people have powerful feelings about the traffic in Los Angeles, it says something that local officials warned motorists about a temporary road work closure on the 405 last year by calling it Carmageddon. Angelenos took the hint, and this weekend they're expected to steer clear of the latest 405 closure, named, of course, Carmageddon 2. That's how it is in L.A., a snarl of overstuffed freeways and commuters who keep their cool, except when they don't. KPCC's Stephen Cuevas has this profile of a punk rocker whose music expresses the insanity of L.A. traffic while extolling the virtues of public transit.
Couple of things you need to know about Eddie Solis. He lives in L.A., loves the band Kiss, and does not own a car.
Being someone who's from L.A., born and raised, and, you know, having a few cars in my past, I saw the city much differently through a different perspective through the eyes of a bus rider.
Want to just go all the way to the back?
Sure. Line 18, Wilshire Western Station.
Just steps from the front door of his home, across the street from a tortilla factory in L.A.'s Boyle Heights neighborhood, Solis catches a bus that connects him with the city's subway and the commuter train he catches to his day job at an indie record label in Hollywood.
It just opened me up to, like, little neighborhoods, galleries, clubs, bars, just everything. Just seeing what's out there, little pockets of the city.
Solis's journeys aboard L.A. buses and subway cars informs a lot of the material on The New Los Angeles Part 1, Through the Eyes of a Bus Rider, the latest release by the singer-guitarist band It's Casual. In Solis's vision of a new Los Angeles, people abandon their cars, climb aboard public transit, and rediscover their communities. One song extols the virtues of the L.A. County Metropolitan Transit Agency's Easy Pass and the urban underbelly it introduces to the rider.
And that's a nod and homage to, you know, the people who know what you can even go cheaper and really beat the system and really steer away from spending money on gas and oil profits and all that. Is all it takes for me to witness racial tension, for me to witness illegal aliens. It's not to paint a negative picture, it's just my perspective of what is seen.
Off the bus and back on the street, we make our way past a jazz saxophonist playing for pocket change and down a long escalator to catch a train.
So, where are we now?
We're at the Red Line station, the Pershing Square station in downtown L.A.
And what's our destination?
We're going to go down Fairs, another tier, and in about 5 minutes, we're going to get on the Red Line going northbound.
Okay, yeah. Let's go.
The Metro Red Line snakes from North Hollywood to downtown Los Angeles. It's the train that inspired It's Casual's signature tune and spawned a viral internet video. It was partly filmed late at night on a moving train as it hurtles from station to station. Solis thrashes away on his guitar and barks the lyrics, which celebrate the Red Line and call out the congested freeways that coil around Los Angeles.
Este es un tren de Metro Red Line a North Hollywood.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice.
The thread that comes out of the record that ties everyone together is just like, be alive, don't be a victim of having a car.
MTA spokesman said he couldn't comment on Eddie Solis's furious pro-Metro message, but the Red Line video was a hit at the offices of Move LA.
Eddie's done a good job. Thank you, Eddie.
It's the public transportation advocacy group headed by former Santa Monica Mayor Denny Zane. He liked the juxtaposition of Solis blissfully riding L.A. public transit in one scene with scenes of the band raging against those notorious freeway jams.
Eddie is all frantic when he talks about highways. And so mellow when he's like grooving on a skateboard and on the bus and on the Red Line, there's a metaphor for the transformation, you know, from the, oh my God, I just got to get out of the traffic to, hey, this is cool. I can mellow out.
Or you can blast the tune like Too Many People as you claw your way across Los Angeles by car, bus, or skateboard. Too Many People could also be a motto for its casual. Over the years, the band whittled itself down to a power duo of Solis and a rotating cast of drummers. So you may think the burly, bearded punk rocker just can't get along with Freeways, with People, or his native L.A. Not true.
I love it. I love everything about it. I've traveled throughout the U.S. many times, and I could never look forward enough to coming back. The weather, the different cultures, the landscape. I was just like, you know what? Now I know why everyone moves to L.A.
Solis will bring the love and the volume during a Red Line mini tour next month. It's casual will play a different venue within walking distance of several Red Line metro stops from Union Station to West Hollywood. For the California Report, I'm Stephen Cuevas.
That's the California Report, a production of KQED Public Radio in San Francisco. Our director this week is Nina Thorson. Seal Muller is our technical producer. We had additional engineering from Danny Bringer and Howard Gelman. Thanks to Hank Hadley at KCBX. Our online team includes Lisa Pickoff-White, David Marks, and Don Clyde. Our interns are Catherine Borgeson and Rachel Johnson. Tyke Hendricks is our elections editor with production help from Tina Lauerberg. We had editing support from Paul Rogers. Victoria Malione is our associate senior producer. Ingrid Becker is our senior producer. The news director is Bruce Kuhn. I'm Rachel Miro. Thanks for listening and have a great weekend. This is the California Report.
Funds for the California Report are provided by the James Irvine Foundation, expanding opportunity for the people of California and supporting the California Report since its premiere in 1995. And the California Endowment, health happens in schools, at calendow.org. And Chevron, investing in renewables, strengthening communities, and creating jobs. More information at chevron.com.
The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the 210, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 210, the 605, the freeways are not so nice. I-5, the I-10. The I-5, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The 101, the 405, the freeways are not so nice. The 605, the 101, the 101, the 101, the I-10, the 210, the 605, the 101, the 405, the I-10, the freeways are not so nice. The red light.
It's on the 110. So, I'll talk to him about a minute or two and we'll take a little break.
The red light! The red light! The red light!
Hey, welcome to Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host, Edward Solis. In studio guests tonight, Crazy Craig, Craig McDonald from KNAC.com. We'll get to him in a minute. Just wanted to express how happy I am to have myself in with Craig tonight on a Friday. downtown Los Angeles, so much going on. We got a Dodger game over the hill, and the Lakers playing at Staples Center with San Antonio, third game of the playoff series. And, yeah, tons of action in downtown tonight. Just crazy, crazy walking and trying to cross the street. Almost got ran over about four times, being the pedestrian that I am. But it comes with the territory. Anyhow, I'm really excited to talk to Craig because I've been on his show many times. And KNAC goes so far back. I mean, it was an institution of a radio show back in the 80s and 90s. And, you know, I got to tell you, I mean, back then when FM was strong and there was no internet happening, you would have a station that was completely going against the grain of the mainstream. The format was, you know, very eclectic. I mean, it was all rock and metal based, but every subgenre would get played. I mean, they would play during the day. You would hear, you know, the big four. You would hear Metallica, you know, Slayer, Megadeth, and Anthrax. And they would get into the whole format of, you know, the more mainstream stuff as far as the rock goes, like, you know, the Guns N' Roses and Kiss and Def Leppard. But then, you know, they would have these specialty shows and in Los Angeles and all of SoCal, you would pick up the frequency 105.5 KNAC FM dial, and you would hear like special, you know, shows on like at midnight. They would have Manic Metal with John Schultz, you know, Mosh and John, and he would play, you know, everything from, you know, Morbid Angel to local bands like Resistant Militia. You know, you would hear, you know, Death, you know, just some really extreme stuff back then. And then there would be times where they play a lot of hardcore. You would hear, you know, at times you would hear Black Flag, DRI, Final Conflict. And it was really a platform for fans to go to and, you know, just really collect information and listen to the music they wanted to. And it was 24/7, and things changed. Now they're on the air. So we'll come back with Crazy Craig McDonald, and we'll get into certain areas that he grew up in, like Long Beach, Cerritos area, highlight those areas, and East Hollywood, where he currently resides. Welcome back. We'll come back in a few minutes. Thank you.
This is Ignacio Salcido from Mama School The Bakery in Boyle Heights. You're listening to LA Nista and SkidRowStudios.com. Yeah.
This episode of Los Angeles Nista is brought to you by La Mascota Bakery, a family-owned business serving the community since 1952. Tamales and sweetbread, made the old-fashioned way daily.
for yourself.
We'll be right back.
Los Angeles Nista. I'm your host, Edward Solis. We just heard some It's Casual. That was some tracks from the upcoming release, the new Los Angeles Part 2, Less Violence, More Violins. We heard Keep the Children Occupied, Less Violence, More Violins, and that'll be out in June of 2013 on vinyl and CD and cassette. It's available right now on Spotify and iTunes. And we heard that last song, and in this block of music, that was pro skateboarder Mike Vallely, his band called Good For You. And the backstory to that is pretty interesting. In 2001, It's Casual was playing shows with Mike V and the Rats. And that is Mike V, pro skateboarder. And we struck up a relationship. And at one point in 2003, when I was working for SST, I introduced Mike Vallely to Greg Ginn. And at that time, Greg Ginn had a plan to do the Black Flag reunion. It was September of 2003, and it was two nights at the Palladium, Friday and Saturday night. It was, yeah, September, I want to say, the week of the 10th or 12th. And Mike ended up seeing a set on that reunion block. They did a really long set, and they had Mike sing the whole My War album front to back. Pretty phenomenal stuff. You know, a lot of Black Flag fans will have a lot to say about the singers and who's singing what. Yeah, Mike Vallely is not an original singer of Black Flag, but he is sincerely a huge fan of Greg Ginn's work, as I am. So when Greg called on him to sing the My War record on the Black Flag reunions that took place in 2003, Mike delivered. He was at practice all the time, and, you know, Black Flag would rehearse at the SST office in Long Beach. And it was really cool to see it all go down, rehearsals, and then, you know, go to the Palladium both nights and see the shows happen. Fast forward 2006, I get a call from Mike to play bass in a band called Revolution Mother, a band he was starting. And he liked the vibe of It's Casual, so he started a new band after Mike V and the Rats. And he actually called on It's Casual to be his rhythm section. So I was playing bass, and the drummer from It's Casual, WCE, who's played on all the It's Casual records, all the recordings you've heard out there, he was on drums and was phenomenal. I mean, we founded the band with Mike. We did a long rehearsal schedule, and we started the band, I want to say, late 2005, mid-2005. And then 2006, 2007, we're touring. One of our first tours was with CKY, and it was a great time, a great experience, you know, playing these great venues. And, you know, the It's Casual rhythm section, we moved on. And at that point, we went to make a record. That's when we did the first New Los Angeles, which is our third one. We did that, and we're really inspired to play with Mike. So from the inspiration of the experiences with Mike across the country and touring with bands like CKY, we went in the studio and did this record, and that's when I fired all guns for It's Casual to start, you know, doing a lot and, you know, making videos directed by Rick Kosick, and also really working hard on getting press and, you know, writing material and going out and playing shows with like Fu Manchu and Mastodon and High on Fire and Zeke. And, it's really amazing how everything comes full circle. You know, Mike met Greg in 2003, and 10 years later, he's in a band called Good For You. Now, Good For You has a new album on SST Records that came out in February. And that last song we just heard, that's a Good For You track. So Good For You is actually on tour with Black Flag. So the LA show for the Black Flag Good For You tour is going to be Sunday, July 14th at the Vex. You get your tickets at Headline Records or buy them online at brownpapertickets.com. It's Casual is going to be actually opening the show. That's going to be a phenomenal lineup. And as far as things coming full circle, you know, Mike is also managing Black Flag. And there's a brand new article up there right now on rollingstone.com. If you just Google rollingstone.com, Mike V, Black Flag, you'll see a very, very interesting feature that just ran. And it's, you know, It's the divide between Black Flag and the group Flag. And it's really interesting read and to see Mike's take on all of it. And so this song we just heard was from Good For You. And Mike, you know, is doing a lot with his skate company, Elephant Brand, and also doing a, you know, the Good For You touring and managing Black Flag. So good for him. Good for him. Okay, we're going to take another break and we'll be back in a minute.
Hi, this is Eddie Solis. You're listening to Los Angeles Nista on SkidRowStudios.com. We'll be right back.
We'll be right back.
Orale, homie, we're back. The freeways are not so nice. Now, you drove in from Hollywood.
Yes.
The 101 in Hollywood.
Yep.
How long did it take you to get to downtown Los Angeles?
Oh, almost an hour and a half.
90 minutes, all pretty much.
Yeah.
Okay.
And 20 minutes of that were spent sitting in one place right at Alvarado.
Gotcha. So, as stated in the red line, the freeways are not so nice.
You're darn tootin', dude.
Well, Craig, thank you so much for being here. You know
sure.
what? This is like full circle because you have your own show on KNEC.com called the Super Rock Sunday Show with Crazy Craig.
Yes.
And I've been on many times. I'm a friend of the show.
Yep.
I love to go on your show and talk about my music and my band. And, you know, I've been on many times and I know you as a friend and I hear your podcast and I hear you do it live and now you're here and we get to talk on my show.
I know.
And I'm really stoked because
this is the first time I've actually been on someone else's show.
Really?
Yeah.
So it's your inaugural appearance on another radio show.
Yes.
Very cool. So I know you've got the gist of Los Angeles Nista and what the format is.
Yeah.
So what we do is we cover, you know, areas of Southern California and Los Angeles County and let people know what's going on out there. Because a lot of people that listen aren't from L.A., And they don't know suburbs or certain pockets of L.A. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah.
So, like, tonight, I got friends at the Santa Fe Spring Swap Meet watching a Ramones cover band off the 5. And it's like, if I try to tell people that I know that work in the entertainment industry that are not from here, mm-hmm. where that is, they don't know.
Oh, no.
Of course not.
Dude, remember that one time we were driving down to the slide bar and I told you, yeah, we used to skate in that ditch right there in front of Santa Fe.
That's the rat hole. Yeah.
The Santa Fe Springs Drive-In.
The rat hole.
I couldn't believe that you knew that. I was like, damn. That's crazy.
Exactly. Okay. So let's get into it here. I want to let everyone know what exactly your history is with KNAC when it was on the FM dial. Because as explained before, in the beginning of the show, you know, this is before the internet. This is before iTunes and downloading stuff. And having phones that were making things accessible, like information, entertainment, there was the FM dial.
Yeah.
And that you know, now the FM dial is programmed by a robot. And they play the same stuff, like the sound or the Jack 103. It's like everything's in rotation. There's no DJs.
Yeah.
Okay.
I mean, it's overly market research to the point where it's like
It's so sterile.
Yeah, they think that this is what people want to listen to, but it's not. And nowadays we have alternatives, you know, with like satellite radio and whatnot. But, you know, for a while there, it was just mind numbing.
Sure.
Yeah.
Sure. Well, let's talk about your involvement in the beginning with KDC, because when you were involved, I was just a little kid living in Whittier, junior high and high school. Skateboarding, listening to music, playing in bands, and I couldn't wait to, like, you know, get in my room and listen to KNAC all night. Because as time went on, as it got later, that's when the specialty shows came on.
Yeah.
And that's when you would play the hardcore punk and a lot of the speed metal and all the good stuff. So how did you take us back?
Okay.
How did you end up at KNAC?
Let me preface it with this. I went to Jamaica to smoke weed.
Okay.
I was working construction for my uncle, and I went. I saved up enough money to go just smoke weed. That's all I went to Jamaica for. And when I came back, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take some.
Wait. How long were you in Jamaica?
A week.
And you completely smoked your head off for a week straight.
I ate a ganja cake that put me in the hospital, too.
Hey, Jeremy, have you ever had a ganja cake?
Yeah, like a space cake or something?
Yeah,
like
only...
That. Space cake.
Only this ganja cake was the size of a Bundt cake, and it was totally green.
So you ate the whole thing?
I ate the whole thing, and I was only supposed to eat one piece, and I ate 8 pieces, and, like, literally, I was hallucinating dinosaurs.
In front of you?
Oh, yeah. And it put me in the hospital in Jamaica.
Rubosaurus Rex?
Yeah.
So
Tokosaurus.
Tokosaurus Rex.
So when I came back, I was like, you know what? I'm going to take some courses at Long Beach City College.
Okay.
And I'm like, so I took a video production class, which I had to petition to get into because it was like third year, you know, it was like a junior level course. You know, you had to have prerequisites and stuff. But I'd already taken a bunch of video classes in high school, so that was easy enough. And then I also took this radio class. And the teacher for the class happened to be the promotions director at KNEC.
Oh, wow.
And they had not, I think KNEC changed over to an all-metal format maybe a year before that. So this was, I guess this would be going into, it was probably like March of 88.
Okay.
So I took that class and I took the video class and I pretty much aced both of them. And I got in the video class, I won like this plaque for best production. And then in the radio class, I petitioned to be an intern at KNEC because Tom Marr, the promotions director, was my teacher. So
is that the same Tom Marr who became a manager?
Yes. He managed, was a BFD. They managed Guns N' Roses and I forgot who else.
Right, right. He was a teacher and a promotions director at KNEC at the time.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he actually went on to manage Guns N' Roses.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. I see a lot of people that worked at KNEC were all, you know, that was back in the day when, I see KNEC, when it changed over to the all-metal format, it was really like a vanguard kind of thing that happened. Because for one thing, there was never a format that was like that ever. It was all metal, complete metal. And I had always heard that the owner of KNEC, Fred Sands, who was a real estate mogul in Southern California, bought KNEC as kind of like a hobby or whatever, and just a cool thing. And then decided to, they tried to create a format that they thought would never make money. That was the joke.
Okay.
So they said all metal format. And it kind of backfired and just became this super huge thing. Like worldwide, you know, like every metal band at the time, like in their videos, they had a KNEC shirt on.
Or someone in the audience.
Yeah, somebody.
The camera would go on someone in the audience wearing a KNEC shirt.
Yeah. It was a very special thing. And so I petitioned for a production internship and they hired me. So in fall of 1988, I started my production internship at KNEC, not really knowing what the fuck I was doing because I had not taken any kind of production classes whatsoever. I'm like, oh, why did I pick this? I should have picked programming because I knew music like the back of my hand.
Right.
But I didn't know how to like say, you know, produce a spot and do all that stuff, right? So pretty much my first day going in, they introduced me to Nasty Neil.
Okay, I remember Nasty Neil.
He was on air, and he was also the head of production guy.
Right.
Neil, there's a reason why they called him Nasty Neil, because he had the worst attitude ever, dude. And literally, I walked in there, and he goes, oh, so you know what you're doing? Where'd you go to school? And I'm like, oh, I didn't go to school. I go, I thought, you know, I was coming here to learn. And he opened up a cabinet, got the manual for the board out and threw it in my lap and goes, here you go, and walked out.
That was it.
and then just left me to my own vices.
Wow.
But I would come in there like late at night, you know, and I learned that board, man, and I learned how to make spots. And then eventually,
so you were actually producing spots.
Oh yeah.
Like commercials and stuff like that.
And then eventually after that, I was writing the ad copy because I was the consumer that they were trying to attract. You know, I was like 21, I think.
Oh, okay.
I was like 21, I think. And, you know, there was spots for like, Wild Rags and Whittier, you know, the record
Montebello. Whittier Boulevard, yeah.
What else? Electric Chair and Huntington Beach.
Yeah, so all those outlets, all those advertisers would take out an ad and you would write the copy.
Well, I didn't write the copy at first, but I think the first one I wrote was for Paramount Skates.
I remember that. Yeah.
It was like
skateboard shop.
Yeah, in Paramount. And, the ad executive was having trouble, trying to come up with some stuff that would attract, new customers to these vendors and shit. So they would come to me and ask me, I was like, oh, okay, yeah. So I started writing ad copy and, I got so good at it that they just would let me write the stuff and then I would take it in. I would produce the spot, voice it, put it on the cart, run it right into the studio, and there it was. And I learned all that shit on my own.
And I'm
without
going
anybody teaching me.
That's great. And I'm going back, replaying that time period in my head, all those commercials. I remember the Paramount Skates and the Wild Rags and, this, at that time period. And I remember hearing that and knowing that, you're the one that made it. It was just kind of cool. How things, because, back then, KDC was like my world. Like, yes, I'm 13 years old.
Yeah.
I'm in the eighth grade, and my Saturday night is going to be playing my acoustic guitar with two strings and listening to KDC all night.
Hey, dude.
I'm looking at skate mags.
You know what? KDC was my world, too, because ever since I was a little kid, all I wanted to do was be on radio.
Okay.
Like, I was that kid that would sit in on a Saturday night with his buddies with a tape recorder. And we would make up our own, radio shows and stuff like that. That's what I do as a kid, and I just wanted to be on radio. So here I am, at this awesome station at the right place at the right time of, metal. And
radio.
And radio.
Before the internet, everyone's tuning into the FM dial. It's a big deal.
And KDC was still a small station. It wasn't owned by a conglomerate or network or any of that. It was still independent. I was there. I was at radio, and here's rock stars walking in left and right. Nice.
Like who, for instance?
Do you name it, man? Anybody at the time? Rat, Slayer, God, Poison, Motley Crue. Everybody, every metal band.
Interviews and all that.
Oh yeah, it's like I didn't really do any interviews there.
But you would see them coming in for their interviews.
And, oh, yeah, yeah.
Things like that. But you know what? I got a confession. I got an amazing confession. One time, I was so infatuated with winning something.
Yeah.
Yeah. You want to know what I won? Are you ready for this?
Tickets to Irvine Meadows?
No. I won two things on KNAC.
Okay. What'd you
and
mean?
I must have been about 13, 14 years old.
Uh-huh.
First thing I won. Now, get this. Okay, I'm saying this is, I always say this. This is pre-internet.
Did you win that Dokken record?
No. I won a VHS cassette.
Oh,
with
yeah.
With one video on it.
Oh.
Of Alice Cooper Poison.
Yeah, the promo video?
Yeah.
Why were they giving that away?
That's what they gave away on the air, and I called.
That's weird.
And I had my mom get in her Chevy Nova and drive down to 605 to go pick it up, to take me to pick it up. And I walked in,
yeah.
And I was just like, wow. I was just like, I'm in a radio station. Remember,
yeah.
I was just, there was the door. It was right by the Queen Mary,
yep.
Shoreline Village. And I was like, I'm like, get out of the car, went by myself. I think I must have been 13 or 14 years old, like eighth grade, summer going into freshman year in high school, right?
Yeah.
Really young.
Uh-huh.
And so... I'm looking through the glass doors and it's like ring the bell, mm-hmm. And then they're like, yeah, what are you here for? I'm like, I want a contest. Bzz, yep. Go in. I'm like, I want a contest. What's your name? Eddie Sillies here. Yeah. I was like, wow, I wanted to stay there. You know what I mean? It was like such a huge deal to me.
Dude, I felt the same way, man. Like every time I went in there, I was like, sometimes I couldn't sleep the night before because I knew I was going into
KDC. Because you were so stoked?
I was so stoked, man. Here
you couldn't even sleep the night before?
Sometimes, yeah, I would just be sitting there just thinking. It's like, oh, I get to go to KDC tomorrow. I get to go to the radio station tomorrow. Because this is my dream come true, It's like...
It's a huge deal.
Yeah, this is what I always wanted to do, and now I'm doing it. And, I couldn't tell you all the... the amazing experiences I had down there at KNEC when I was on the air.
So
I
mean, let me ask
too many.
Right. I want to ask you one. I want to hone in on one. Now, back in the day when KNEC was like, you know, really, really, really a part of SoCal lifestyle, you know, because of all the music, all the heavy music they played. And like I said, in the specialty shows, I even got into real extreme metal and some hardcore punk. I remember hearing ads back in the day where, you know, it would be KNEC night at this club in Hollywood or this club in Lakewood or this club in Long Beach.
Yep.
And there was multiple KNEC nights happening.
Yes.
And you would DJ those.
Yes.
Now, I'm a huge KISS fan.
Mm-hmm. Oh, you want me to tell you the KISS story?
Yeah. Tell me what happened. If I remember correctly, they were doing a signing when KISS Alive 3 came out, right? Revenge?
I can't remember. It was definitely when they took the makeup off. Was it Animalize, maybe?
Yeah, 84? No, that's 84. Crazy Nights, 87. Hot in the Shade, 91.
Hot in the Shade, that's what it was.
That's 91.
And I was DJing a night. I actually started the KNEC scene. Well, I guess I didn't start the KNEC nights because the first one was at the Red Onion in Huntington Beach. But I think the second one was this place called Fashions on the Redondo Beach Pier, which is now called Brixton?
The Brixton, yeah.
Yeah. And so they needed DJ to go down there and do it because, Red Onion provided their own DJs, and those guys didn't really know metal anyway, and here I am.
And that was vinyl, right?
Oh, totally. I had to haul, like, four milk crates of vinyl every Sunday
night. No one was showing up with an iPod or a laptop.
No.
It was, like, crates.
Crates of records, dude.
Yeah.
Four of them. And so, okay, what am I getting at? The KISS story, right?
Yeah, you're right.
Okay, so... the owner, I think he knew Paul Stanley, and he had Paul Stanley and Gene Simmons come down, and they were gonna sign stuff, and so I'm like, all right, cool. And previously, like a month or two before this night, I was at the Foundations Forum in Burbank,
right? The music industry conference.
Yeah. And Gene Simmons was like the keynote speaker, and he had people, you know, come up and ask him questions, you know, and all these people were like asking the dopiest questions ever, like,
back in 78 and blah 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 and whatever.
And I get up there and I was like, because he had just created the Simmons Records,
right?
And was
through RCA.
yeah and he was talking about how if you're a band nowadays, and this is back in 88, I think. No, 89 or
89,
if you're a band nowadays, you know, there's only one way to make it, and you've got to get signed, and you got to do this and this stuff. And I got there, I'm like, that isn't the way that you can get signed. And I just started, like, it just totally, going against them, right? And there's like in a room full of like probably 1,500 people, and I'm on the mic, and like I go, look at Metallica. This is before KNEC started playing Metallica too. Look at Metallica. Metallica's a pretty big band, and they did it all on their own, and they don't have to make videos, and they don't have to do this, and I just started spouting off all of this like underground
lingo,
cred, how I knew bands that how they did it, Slayer and stuff like that. And so everybody started like siding with me, like, and like pretty soon Gene was just like, well, blah blah blah, your name is, and I'm like, Craig McDonald, like, and I'm an intern at KNEC. And he's like, blah, blah. So anyway, afterwards, I went up to him. I'm like, I go, look, I understand that you have a record label. And, I'd really like to, if you need people to, like, be like A&R scouts or whatever, it's like, I would love to do that for you. And he just kind of looked at me. He goes, what do you know about music?
He told you that.
Yeah. He goes, you're just a kid. He goes, what do you know about it? He goes, what do you know about rock and roll? He goes, I've been in rock and roll since blah, 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 you know, and I'm like, and I'm just like, whatever. So I'm already pissed, you know, I'm like, right. Oh, motherfucker.
Yeah.
Okay, so flash forward to
Redondo Beach Pier. Now you're a DJ.
And now I'm a DJ, and I'm fucking, and here comes Gene Simmons and Paul Stanley, and like, Gene Simmons comes into my booth, and we were about, I don't know, playing a song or whatever, and we're about to announce that they're here, and they're going to sit down, and, you know, you can get in line and have stuff signed, and I go, oh, Gene Simmons.
You tell him that?
Yeah. And it's just me and him in the booth, right?
The old school glass booth.
Yeah. No one can hear us. And I start telling him, I go, remember me at Foundations Forum when you were telling this and blah, 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 blah. And I stood up and told you that's not the way that, you know, that's not the only way that they can do it. And you sort of like, how dare you? And you don't know music. And like, we started arguing, right?
In the booth, right before he's going to start signing.
He goes, I remember you. He goes, yeah, you're just a kid. You don't know shit. I go, now I'd be like, guess what? You're an old man. I go, I used to have a poster of you on my wall, and now I'm ashamed that I ever had it there. And like, all of a sudden, like, you know, I'm pretty sure, like, to somebody outside the booth looking at us, they're probably like, oh, those guys are having a pretty heated conversation.
Because you can't hear.
You can't hear, but you can see us talking, right? And so all of a sudden I see this, right? And I pull up the microphone. I go, hey, fashions, blah, blah, blah. I go, here with Gene Simmons. And he gets on the mic and puts his arm around me. He goes, I'm here with my old friend, Crazy Craig. He goes, we were just catching up because I haven't seen him in a while. And I was like looking at him like, you know, old man. So they sit down, right? And like this line forms and, you know, people are getting shit signed. And I grab my double platinum, you know, double gatefold EP, you know, and I'm like, okay, I'll go have them sign it. What the fuck? It's right here. So I go to Paul and Paul signs it. And then I turn to Gene and I go, you know what? You don't deserve to sign this. And he just looks at me while he's signing it, closes the pin on the cap, and then hucks the record at me. Goes, you know you want it.
He tells you that?
Yeah. And I'm like, oh, darn. He's right.
He's right.
And yeah, that was the one Gene Simmons story. I got like eight other ones that would take way too long.
Yeah. So let's go in now into actually... Let's move it. I want to, you know, let everyone know about your background in the music business.
Sure.
And you actually had some time as an A&R guy at a label. You used to work at Malicious Vinyl.
Yes. Malicious Vinyl was this rock part of Dolicious Vinyl, which was primarily a rap label. And I had worked after my internship ended at KNEC, which I got extended to a full year because I was so good at it. I went to Enigma Records first, and I did an internship there, and then I got a job in the mailroom. And then a friend of mine that worked at Enigma, because Enigma was closing, he called me up and asked me if I knew anybody that would want to do his job for a couple of weeks while he went on vacation. And I go, well, what, where do you work? And he goes, oh, I run the mailroom at Dolicious Vinyl. I go, shit, dude, I'll do it.
The rap label.
Yeah. And so I went over there and, you know, did this job for 2 weeks while this guy was gone. And I did it so much better than him and, like, got along with, you know, the people that owned the place. Like, Mike Ross, his brother, Rick, actually went to a junior high that was across town from me.
Okay.
So, and, like, their family got, like, came into a bunch of money and then moved up to Hollywood. But had he had not moved up to Hollywood, we would have went to the same high school.
That's funny.
Me and my boss's brother.
Okay.
So we got along really good. And this is like the first time that this has happened that way, how I got a job, like a really good job like that. So anyway, so then I ended up working at Dolicious for 8 years. And in that 8 years, we created a rock part of the label because they had already had Masters of Reality.
Yeah, Chris Goss.
Yeah, they had a re-release of the Blue Garden record that was on American, and they were signing other rock acts, and so they needed a part division of it to deal with it.
And that's
so,
where Malicious Vinyl came in.
That's where it came in. And it was basically just me and this English guy, Paul Ellis, that pretty much ran the whole thing. I did like A&R and marketing for this label. We had Masters of Reality, Slow Burn, which was John Garcia from Caius. We had Excel,
right,
from Venice,
right,
and Shrine, which was the singer Zan Cassavetes. Is her father is John Cassavetes, and her mom's Gina Rollins. Mm-hmm. It's like famous film family.
Sure.
And then I signed this band called Lit.
And there you have it.
And yeah. And then
now, when you signed Lit, was their sound pretty much the same?
No, it was. They were a lot more metal when I signed them. They were almost like a harder Nirvana.
Okay.
And when I saw them, I was actually DJing a club for KNEC, because even though I had left KNEC, I was still DJing clubs for them for years later.
Sure.
And
while you held your A&R job at Malicious.
Yeah, exactly. Because nobody knew the music, and they used to call me the plumber. Because clubs would have, some kind of metal DJ in place, and they just found out that the guy couldn't cut it. So they would always call me in, and because I would come in and clean up.
Right, exactly.
I'd clean up and get their club rolling again,
Now,
so anyway,
as far as your DJ culture goes, I mean, we're going to take a right turn and go down a road where I think a lot of your DJ skills come from walking in to backyard cha-cha parties.
Yeah, I told you this before.
Like in Pico Rivera, uh-huh, and Norwalk. Like, it's easy for someone to say, I'm a DJ.
Mm-hmm.
But can you really mix records? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think in the metal world, that's very hard to do because the tempos are so over the place. And when I hear you do DJ gigs, like at the Slide Bar or anywhere else, it's just like night and day. Like, it's like a real live DJ throwing it down.
Thanks, man.
Yeah, for sure. And the thing is would you say that some of that like culture of the like, going to these like backyard parties in heavily Latino areas and hearing live DJs kind of like resonated and spilled over into your skill of DJing?
Oh, no, it totally set me up for it. It's like, that's how I learned. It's like, I'd be in like, parties like in downtown Long Beach before it got really bad, with gangs and stuff. And so you're talking about like early 80s.
Right.
83. And, like you said, these cha-cha parties in Whittier. Like, so I remember seeing like Exposé and like Pico at a backyard party, Stacey Q, stuff like that, And
that's the shit.
Yeah. I mean, I was just this music sponge, pretty much. Like, my parents grew up, I didn't even listen to rock music when I was a kid. My parents were into disco.
Okay.
And so that's another reason how I kind of learned how to DJ, was because of just the, learning beats and stuff like that, And I just knew beats and stuff from listening to all those dance records that my parents had. So, so I would go to these parties, and like I'd see the DJ and I'd just be, wow, I could do that, I go, that's something that's easy, easy for me to just pick up. And it was right at the beginning of that shit, like Run DMC and all that stuff. That was just like right then,
Right.
So I kind of learned how to do it right at the start of all that stuff. And, I was doing like backyard parties and stuff. Even when I was in high school, like I was a mobile DJ at 16 and doing like college parties and stuff. It was pretty crazy.
A mobile DJ at 16. Yeah. I must take a lot of work to advertise yourself.
I had three partners that were way older than me, but we had all been in a scooter club.
Okay.
And so that's how that's how I knew them. And I was like the youngest member in this like mod scooter club.
Okay.
And after the club kind of disbanded, we just, you know, a couple of us were like, let's get some DJ equipment and just, you know, start doing it. And, you know, we got a lot of gigs, you know, from just people in the, you know, like the underground music scene and stuff. Did a lot of mod parties.
Sure. Now, you know what? You were actually in a band. You sang in a band called Satan A Go Go.
Oh, so anyway, let me finish.
I did my research.
So eventually, like, yeah, it kind of spilled over into doing the whole metal thing. But there's one constant that runs through it being a DJ in a club setting, and that is you got to know what to play to make people do what you want.
Exactly.
And like I've witnessed
that. I've seen you do it, and it amazes me because, you know, we talk about the art of DJing, and it's like you play records, but like not only are you mixing, but I've seen you like just take it up and just peek everyone out,
yeah,
and then take it back down and then like peek it up again.
Yeah.
And I've seen like I've never witnessed the art of DJing metal, yeah, the way you have. I'm not just saying to kiss your ass, but I've seen the result, and it's the same every time.
Oh, probably because most of these so-called DJs nowadays never had to do it. Like, you know, they just come, they just show up to someone's
club. They walk into Guitar Center and buy their DJ software.
Yeah. You know, they got their laptop and their, you know, their iPod, and they think that's DJing, where I actually had to haul
mix records
and I had, you know, I had to, you know, keep the dance floor packed. You know how hard it is to keep a dance floor packed when you're playing metal?
It's hard.
It's like probably the hardest genre of music to do that.
Right.
And, you know, you have to, you know, try to keep the dance floor packed, and then you got to sell drinks. And, you know, I mean, there's times that you got to do this and that. And that's how I learned. And it just kind of ended up becoming just like a second nature to me. And I think I pretty much was one of the people that wrote the book on it, even though I never really wrote a book. But like I was there at the beginning, and no one told me how to do it. I just had to, you know, trial and error from doing so many Caney C gigs, you know?
Right, right. Yeah. So as far as your experience with, you know, working at Caney C, I mean, when that ran its course, you were still DJing on location while you had your A&R job. Now, when you were working in the music industry, that was when it was excessive, and there was a lot of extra money to promote. Let's talk about the most excessive party you've ever thrown on the Sunset Strip during Foundations Forum.
Okay.
Let's talk about what was free to come see the Malicious Vinyl bands.
Yeah.
You provided free
drugs and alcohol and pizza and hookers.
Right. And that's how you guys promoted the, Foundations Forum had like a CMJ format after, yeah, right? And you guys had a showcase that was like at the Roxy or something?
The Whiskey.
Whiskey. And
we had a party on the rocks, above the rocks. Right. That was just down the street.
Right. So it's like an industry thing. So, yeah. And you're promoting your event to journalists and radio guys and retailers.
Yeah, people from all over the world, you know, were in town for this thing. Yeah.
And you're saying, come to our party because this will be free. And this being?
The free drugs and alcohol party. But see, I was the marketing person in Malicious Vinyl, so like I had to think, you know, I've been to all these fucking, so I can cuss, right?
Yeah, yeah.
It's on the line. never mind. I don't know what I was thinking. I got my own show where I'm cussing up a storm.
Yeah, that's good. Green light.
So, you know, I've been to all these conventions, man, and I've seen like people, you know, like throw parties and they're just duds, you know? And so I knew what it was going to take to try to get people down to this party, and, you know, from like, instead of going to some other gig, because that was the year where it wasn't at Burbank. Like they would have, It was spread out all over, like all these clubs all over Hollywood.
So it was like CMJ where like it's all happening simultaneous.
Yeah. And so, and you know, nobody had heard these bands that we had on our label. So in order to get people to come down, I go, let's just give them free drugs and alcohol and pizza. And I go, and I'll call some hookers and hook them up with some like nerdy radio people when they're in town.
Right, right, right. So let me ask you a question. Now, when you walked into your boss to get him to sign off on this marketing expense.
Yeah.
I mean, obviously, you had to be very transparent and tell him exactly what you're going to do.
Oh, so, I told them. They all knew what I was about.
Pretend I'm the boss. How'd you come in?
I go, Rick, I'm going to need to get an 8-ball of Coke and an ounce of weed for this party.
Why?
Because we need to grease people.
Okay. That's how it went down.
He goes, okay, go to I forgot her name, Karen, and tell her how much you need. So I go, all right. So I go to Karen and I'm like, I need like about $600. And she's like, for what? I go, well, I need to get some cocaine and marijuana. she's like, okay, can you get a receipt for this? I was like, are you kidding me? And she's like, I just thought I'd ask.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Interesting. So, very interesting. So we
rolled all the weed up into joints and put them in a bag, and I put all the fucking coke in like this bullet. And I was DJing, so people would come up to me at the DJ booth and like, hey, where's all these free drugs that we heard about? I go, oh, what color? Green or white? And somebody would be like, green. And I'd get in the bag, hand them a joint, and I go, there you go. Or somebody would go, white. I go, yep, here you go. Here's the bullet. Just like, dude. And it was free alcohol and pizza. Dude, by the time we walked out of that place to go down, just walk two blocks to go down to the whiskey to see the bands, there was the biggest crowd of drunken metal buffoonery going on.
Just walking together.
Because everybody was fucking hammered out of their minds.
Before the show. But so, you got them all there.
I got them all there. They all went. Nobody left to go to another show. They all just walked down the street and got in and saw Lit and Slow Burn. And Nebula.
Oh, right, right.
We were thinking about signing Nebula.
So you put them on a showcase.
We put them on a showcase.
I was actually at that showcase.
Yeah, and that was when Nebula had Scott Reeder from Caius playing bass.
Yeah.
Because I think that's when Mark...
Abshire.
Yeah, I think that was when Mark left or something happened. I can't remember.
I remember that time. Mm-hmm. So, like, as far as your current show, KNAC.com, how long has that been running?
It... has been running for 15 years this March. About a month ago.
Congrats on that. And as far as your experience with, like, you know, you grew up in Long Beach.
Yeah.
Okay. So, like, did you ever trek off into Cerritos and Norwalk?
Well, actually, I lived in Cerritos. I lived in Lakewood for a while I went to Lakewood High School. And then my mom got remarried and moved to Downey. So I went to go live with my dad because he bought a house in Cerritos.
Okay.
And just used my grandma's address so I could still go to Lakewood.
The old switcheroo.
Yeah. But I lived right behind Cerritos, the mall.
Cerritos Mall. Yeah. Cerritos Auto Square.
That was right when they built, I think they had just built the Cerritos Auto Square.
So back in those days, where would you buy your records?
At Best Records. Which was across the street from the mall where the...
In Cerritos?
Yeah, there was a Toys R Us across the street. And in the little Toys R Us mall behind the Marie Callender's or Coco's, I can't remember which one it was this record store called Best Records. And it really was the best record store that I ever went to. Because, like, I was just a kid. And I used to ride my bike up there from when I lived in Lakewood.
Right.
And because they had the raddest used section ever. And like they had like one of the first used sections that there ever was in a record store.
You never seen used records?
You didn't see used records at all. Nowhere.
Wow.
And they were all these really rad, like, punk records. You know, like fucking... Damned.
Right.
Neat on yellow vinyl. Like, bought it for like a dollar, you know? And I saving up my lunch money and at the end of the week. I would just go in there and I would just clean house.
Buy everything you wanted.
Yeah, pretty much. So by the time I graduated high school, I had a fairly sizable amount of vinyl.
Nice.
Already.
Nice.
Yeah, but that was the best place. And like, I remember one time I walked in there. Because Motley Crue was from there. Well, not Motley Crue, but Tommy Lee, I think his parents lived right there in Cerritos somewhere. And so they would always be in Best Records because this was like before they even put out Too Fast for Love on their own label.
Oh, wow.
And I went in there one day and I'm like, you know, I'm getting Tom Lee's in there talking to the guy and he's in his full fucking Too Fast for Love regalia. You know, he's got like leather and spikes on, like, you know, noon.
Tom Lee and Cerritos.
Yeah. They used to hang out there all the time. So one day I walked in there and I'm getting my records and they started calling me $1.99 kid because at one point one of the guys that worked there was stickering records $1.99 and he just stickered my forehead with it. And so everybody started calling me $1.99 kid. So Tommy Lee's up there and he's like, he's looking at me. He's like, "Hey, punker, what you got there?" And he's like looking at all my punk records. And I'm just like, "Oh, dude, you know."
Oh. I was like, he's like, checking
yeah,
him
he's
out.
Like, yeah, he's like, just took him from me. And he's like, looking at him, "Ah, crap, 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 crap." And I'm like, "Oh, dude, don't take my records." He goes, so he opens his box and he pulls out a Too Fast for Love on leather records. It was the first record out of the box. He goes, "Here, punker, you should buy this." And and the guy behind the counter goes, because he's the $1.99 kid. He doesn't buy anything for more than $1.99. He goes, "Okay, $1.99. I gave him $2 and he gave me a penny back. And I got the first record out of the box.
That's a great Cerritos story.
Yeah, and it's a totally different
pressing.
And I think now it's like worth like $500 or something.
That's
some
cool.
Stuff like that.
You still have it?
Oh yeah.
Nice.
Did I tell this story about when I was in New York at another music convention and I ran into Molly Crew and Nikki saw the tattoo on the back of my leg, the horns, the devil horns.
Let's hear it.
And he goes, "Tommy, come here, man. You got to see this guy's tattoo." So Tommy comes and goes, "Oh man, that's fucking cool, blah, blah." And I'm like, "Do you guys remember me? I was a $1.99 kid at Best Records," and they both looked at me and was like, "Get the fuck out of here. You're the $1.99 kid." Like, they totally remembered me. Like,
that's cool.
You know, 10 years later.
That's cool.
And I was like, and we started talking about Best Records, and, you know, and they're like, "Is it there anymore?" I'm like, "Oh, no." It's like, it turned into this other record store for a while, and then it just eventually just...
Like a hip-hop one, huh?
Wasn't it? I couldn't remember. I don't think it was a hip-hop label, but it wasn't cool anymore. They were, like, trying to make money, so they're selling just anything, you know? And then eventually it went the way of all record stores back then, like Zed's.
You're right.
And... Middle Earth and Downey. That was another great store.
I remember the Ramones at in-store there.
Did they really?
Yeah.
Wow.
Too Tough to Die era. Too Tough to Die era. I went to that, but the line was just too long and no dice.
Yeah.
You know, that was like 88.
Yeah.
But, I mean, being you know, immersed in the in different areas of the business through radio and labels, did you ever pop in on, like, you know, really intimate gigs or backyards to see really huge bands play before?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I saw Megadeth in a backyard party in Whittier with Gene Hoagland, who I went to high school with.
Gene was playing drums for Megadeth?
No, Gene was...
Oh, with him?
Yeah, we just went. I think we were still in high school or just out of high school.
What year was this?
85. Yeah. It was probably the summer... After graduating.
So the first record just came out.
Yeah, probably. Yeah.
Wow.
And, God, who else? I used to see so many fucking bands. Alice in Chains, saw at the Lingerie on Sunset. That is not there anymore. I at least love that place, too.
Now, being in the Cerritos area, do you think Cholo culture ever spilled over into your musical taste, the oldies? The doo-wop.
Oh, totally.
Art LeBeau.
I mean, me and Glenn were talking about Art LeBeau the other day.
Now, you were telling me that before. I mean, Glenn's a huge
Art
LeBeau fan, right? He loves that stuff.
Well, he's not really like an Art LeBeau fan, but he knows who he is.
Because he plays all like the deep cuts.
Yeah. And he's still got a show going on Saturday nights.
Well, actually, it's 7 nights a week now.
Oh, is it really?
On the beat.
Oh, okay. I just remember it being on Saturday nights for some reason.
Well, it was. I mean, that's my hero. If I could have a show every night of the week on radio and have gangsters call in and dedicate songs from jail, fuck, I win.
This is for my spooky. Your hijo loves you. Can't wait to see you when you get out.
You know what's rad? You know what's rad is when you're like go outside and all the cholos down the street are outside working on their car and you're listening to the oldie station and then all of a sudden you hear them call and they're like, yeah, this goes out to all my homeboys working on their car right now. Right? This is the play night owl. Well, you know what, man?
I want to hear Crystal Blue Persuasion.
Well, that wraps it up, man. Thank you so much for coming.
Oh, really? Oh, wow. Damn, dude. Oh, well. What a bummer.
The traffic.
I'm sorry about that. You know what? Dude, have me come down again.
Let's do it.
If you want. I would love to come down.
We'll get it going again.
You know, you are by far the person that's been on my show the most, Eddie.
I hold the record, right?
You hold the record. So I think I have to catch up to you.
Come on again. We'll do it again.
Okay.
We'll eat tamales from La Mascota. The tamales are
great, man.
Yeah, good stuff.
Awesome.
All right, bud. Okay. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye.